from the top. A 5, 6, 7, 8.
Michael Riedel has been a theater columnist for the New York Post since 1998. He worked at the Daily News for 5 years before returning to the Post and has written for The Guardian, Harper's Bazaar, Departures, and Commentary. He's the co-host of Theater Talk with PBS and is a contributor to the BBC. His new book is Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway. It's a vivid biography of Broadway itself, full of larger-than-life characters. It begins with the story of the three Schubert brothers, theater moguls who had a presence across the country, and by the start of the Depression owned and operated some of New York's most important and prestigious theaters. But by the 1970s, Times Square had become the seedy symbol of the city's decline, and the Schubert Organization found itself losing money and business as tourism fell off and theaters were demolished to make room for parking lots. Again, the name of the book is Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Michael Riedel to the roundtable this morning. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
Delighted to do it.
What brought you to want to tell this particular story?
Well, I've been covering Broadway for going on 25 years now, and I got to know some of the wonderful, colorful, behind-the-scenes characters, theater owners and producers. And I would spend long lunches with people like Gerald Schoenfeld, who back then was the chairman of the board of a very powerful Schubert organization. And he would regale me with tales about how difficult things were for Broadway and indeed for Times Square in New York City back in the late 60s and early 70s, when, of course, the city was careening towards bankruptcy and Times Square was not the shining tourist attraction it is today. It was the Times Square of Midnight Cowboy, you know, prostitutes and hustlers and pimps and drug dealers and all that stuff. Nobody wanted to walk along 42nd Street. You feared for your life back then. And indeed, Broadway itself was really struggling because the cultural taste had changed, and suddenly the music of Rodgers and Hammerstein seemed what your grandmother liked. People wanted to hear Motown and the Beatles and the Who and the Rolling Stones. And back then, in the late 60s and early 70s, Broadway attendance fell off a cliff. Broadway lost half its audience between 1968 and 1972. The theaters were dark. They weren't landmarked back then. They were being torn down because they had more value as parking lots than they did as theaters. But I knew these guys like the Schuberts and the Niederlanders and producers like Alex Cohn and Joe Papp at the Public Theater and creators like Michael Bennett, who did The Chorus Line, who stuck by Broadway in that really perilous time and created shows like A Chorus Line, 42nd Street, Cats, Phantom, Les Miserables, that really turned Broadway around and I think also helped lift the fortunes of Times Square and ultimately New York City itself.
How much of it was conscious and how much of it was unconscious in the sense of my God, we have to do something, let's all work together to do it?
Well, the theater world is full of rivalry and treachery and whatnot and backstabbing, as I detail in my book. So these guys are not always keen to work together. I do think, though, particularly on the part of the Schubert Organization, because they really are the spine of Broadway. You know, the Schubert brothers created that empire in the early 20th century, and they dominated the American theater from the 1920s into the 1960s or so. And when Gerald Schoenfeld and his business partner, Bernard Jacobs, took over that company in 1972, they looked around and they said, we have to do something to save this business. I mean, our livelihoods, our survival is tied up in this business. And they set about really developing and finding shows and backing people like Michael Bennett, Bob Fosse, and also going to the city officials and saying, you've got to do something to clean up this neighborhood. I mean, for years, Jerry Schoenfeld was kind of a one-man band demanding that the city do something to try to clean up Times Square at a time when people had turned their backs on Times Square. I mean, I remember Jerry in my long lunches with him saying he would go to Ed Koch and say, Ed, you've got to do something to clean up Times Square. And Koch's attitude was, where's Broadway going to go? New Jersey? I've got other problems right now. Leave me alone. But the Schuberts pushed very aggressively for the piecemeal overtime cleanup of Times Square, sometimes block by block. Now, when you come up with shows like A Chorus Line and David Merrick came up with 42nd Street and the people came up with Annie, I don't think they were consciously saying, we're going to have these big hit shows that are going to change the business and bring lots of people to New York. They just wanted to get a show on. And I guarantee you, Michael Bennett never in his wildest dreams thought A Chorus Line would become the longest running show. In fact, the night before it played its very first preview at the Public Theater, he was in the alleyway with his good friend, Tommy Toon. And he looked up at Tommy because Michael was small and Tommy's 6'6" tall. And he said, it's never going to work. They're never going to get it. They're not going to understand what I'm trying to do. And, you know, the first number happened. God, I hope I get it. And the place exploded.
I really need this job. Please, God, I need this job. I've got to get this job.
So you never know. These guys, as talented as they are, they never know what they have until that show plays its first performance in front of a live audience. You know, Cameron McIntosh and Andrew Lloyd Webber will tell you that they hid in the back of the theater when Cats played its first performance at the New London in England, in London, because they thought, my God, this show's a disaster. They're going to boo us out of town. And it turned out to be one of the most successful shows of all time. And I try to convey that in the book, that the shows that seem completely bizarre on paper are the ones that become the hits. I mean, if somebody had come to you and said, hey, I'm going to turn this 1,000-page 19th-century French novel about a guy who steals bread into a Broadway musical, are you going to invest? If you said no, you passed on Les Miserables.
So you have these two gentlemen, Bernard Jacobs and Gerald Schoenfeld, and really the heroes of the story. These are two lawyers who look to say, okay, we can create something here. At what point is it a real estate story meets an arts story in the sense of an actual theatrical story?
Well, real estate and art have always been commingled on Broadway because you may have the greatest show in the world, but if you have no theater to put it in, no one's ever going to see it. The other side of the coin is you may have terrific theaters, but if there are no shows to go in those theaters, no one's going to come in and pay a ticket and sit in your theater. So for Broadway to work, you really have to have the theater owners and the producers out there backing the artists. And I think the key relationship that I tried to detail, and it was quite complex and sometimes wonderful and sometimes fraught with tension, was the relationship between Bernard Jacobs when he was running the Schubert Organization and Michael Bennett, who was creating A Chorus Line and Dreamgirls.
Every man has his own special dream. Dreams just about to come true. Life's not as bad as it may seem if you open your eyes to what's in front of you.
Bernie Jacobs recognized that Michael was a singular talent, and he backed anything Michael Bennett did. He knew that he couldn't write the shows, he couldn't come up with the ideas for the shows. That's what Michael Bennett did. And you stuck by the creators like a Michael Bennett, like a Bob Fosse, like a Joe Papp, like a David Merrick, like a Cameron McIntosh or Andrew Lloyd Webber, because they were the ones who were going to envision, create, imagine the shows that were going to fill your theaters. Now, that relationship, as it certainly did with Michael and Bernie, can become quite tricky because, as I say, Broadway is full of rivalries and treacheries. And Bernie Jacobs came to look upon Michael Bennett as a son. And anybody who got close to Michael Bennett, Bernie perceived as a threat. And after A Chorus Line and Dreamgirls and these shows took off and the Schuberts became powerful again, anybody who came between Bernie Jacobs and Michael Bennett got squashed. And in the end, sadly, Michael Bennett had to break free of Bernie's control. And as he was doing, unfortunately, he contracted AIDS. And we forget he died so young. He died at 44 after having done just three shows, A Chorus Line, Ballroom, and Dreamgirls. Had he lived, can you imagine the number of musicals he had in him? Or, for that matter, all the people who would have danced in those shows that he created who all died of AIDS, this next generation of Broadway directors and choreographers who were all wiped out. And AIDS, I think, is a central story in my book and a sad one, too, because of the devastation it wreaked in the Broadway world back in the 1980s and early 90s.
And this is really at the point where all of the work that has been going on in the 70s is coming to fruition, too.
Yes, it's all coming together. All of the groundwork, the shoring up that the Schuberts and Jimmy Niederlander, who owned other theaters on Broadway, did in the 70s. And then things really begin to explode in the 80s with the blockbusters, with Cats, with Les Miserables, with The Phantom of the Opera. I mean, no one had ever made the kind of money on Broadway that those shows did. I mean, I believe the initial investment in Cats was something like $3 million, and the worldwide gross of Cats is $5.5 billion. That's with a B. And the money was really pouring in, and Broadway was really back in the 1980s, and then right at that time, the AIDS crisis hit and started killing a lot of people who worked on Broadway.
Of course, Les Mis and Phantom are still on Broadway, and What does it say about those shows, their staying power, and being good shows?
Well, critics can sneer at Andrew Lloyd Webber, as they certainly enjoy doing, although his latest show, School of Rock, got nice reviews, the best reviews he's ever gotten in New York, frankly.
Yeah.
The critics could turn their noses up at Cats and Phantom, as they did, and poo-poo the Disneyfication of Broadway and whatnot. But if the audience didn't embrace those shows, they wouldn't be around. And not only do people coming to New York love those shows, but those shows play all over the world on a regular basis. So they all have their charms for the vast majority of people. I think their success, though, dovetails with the turnaround of Times Square in New York City. And when New York started to become a tourist destination again, there were these shows here for the tourists to embrace. Now, you could, if you put on your critic's hat, you could say, you know, Broadway is much too dominated. It's too dominated these days by these big, big cartoon musicals or musicals made from famous movies. But that's what the tourists want. And Broadway is a for-profit, big for-profit business, and the producers are giving their customers what they want. And the customers are no longer mainly New Yorkers. The customers today are two-thirds to three-quarters are tourists from all over the world. That makes Broadway a place that is making billions of dollars, but it also perhaps lowers the quality sometimes of the things that we get.
Is that more so with musicals than it is with plays?
Yes. Plays were tricky to have a go on Broadway in the 1980s because the musicals were so dominant. But in the 90s, the producers figured out a way to make the non-musical play work, and that was to cast it with stars. So now you see Al Pacino in China Doll, and you see Hugh Jackman in A Steady Rain, and Daniel Craig in Betrayal, and Denzel Washington in a revival of August Wilson's Fences. What the producers have figured out is that if you get a big star, you give him a run, a limited run of only 16 weeks, people will want to see that star. They will buy out those tickets for the 16 weeks. They give the star a nice piece of the profits at the end of the day, and the star can walk away after 16, 17 weeks worth of work with $3.5 million, and you do the non-musical play. Very tough in this market that is driven by tourists to put on a play that has no stars in it.
And something like Misery with Bruce Willis, even though it gets bad reviews and maybe struggling a little bit, it'll at least make it 16 weeks.
You know, when two-thirds to three-quarters of your audience is coming from Europe and Asia, they're not reading Michael Riedel in the New York Post or Ben Brantley in the New York Times. They're coming, they're looking at their advertising, and they're saying, hey, Bruce Willis, we know that guy from those action-adventure movies. Or they'll say, you know, Al Pacino, my God, he's the guy in The Godfather. Let's go see him in the new David Mamet play, China Doll, even though the play is a disaster and Pacino doesn't know his lines and is stumbling around on stage.
Yeah.
Really quite a pathetic performance. But, you know, despite all the negativity that I've been spreading and others about this terrible Al Pacino production, I popped into the theater occasionally, and throughout the fall, it was doing over $1 million a week at the box office, and it was predominantly Europeans, and they were just having a good time basking in the glow of being in the presence of the guy from The Godfather.
And that show's interesting, too, because it's very short. It's only just a little over an hour.
Not short enough. But, you know, people do ask me, are you going to write a sequel to your book, you know? Because my book ends, Razzle Dazzle ends when Disney comes on the scene with Beauty and the Beast. And then after that, you know, there's Giuliani and the massive cleanup of Times Square and the presence of Disney. But I'm not going to write that story because I was interested in the struggle. I was interested in when Broadway was really finished, when those theaters could have been torn down. And it was just a handful of people who very, very colorful people who stuck by the whole thing. And it's not, to me, as much fun writing about the booming success of Broadway now than it is writing about the struggle to get it there. And the characters were much more colorful back then. I mean, I have a whole chapter on the great and diabolical psychopath, really, David Merrick, when he came back with 42nd Street, which was one of the great shows of all time. And, of course, famously, on the opening night of 42nd Street, Merrick kept the fact that the creator of the show, Gower Champion, had died that morning. And when the curtain came down and the audience was cheering and screaming for this new Broadway hit, Merrick walked out on stage, held up his hands, and announced Gower Champion is dead. And people fainted in the theater. By the way, he wound up on the front page of every newspaper in the world the next day, so he cannily knew what he was doing.
when you look at what that time brought us now, is it cyclical, or are those theaters saved for a good long time now?
Well, nothing lasts, but I have thought for a while that things might slide, and certainly when the financial crisis hit, I thought, boy, this really could burst the Broadway bubble, but it didn't. And I don't see, short of, God forbid, another terrorist attack or something in New York, I don't see this business, Broadway, or the city really going back to what it was in the 1970s. And I think it's entirely possible that The Lion King and Wicked,
no wizard that there is or was, is ever gonna break.
Will never close on Broadway. There will be new generations of people growing up who will want to see The Lion King and will want to see Wicked. So you're now beginning to see theater owners, something they never would have done in the past. They're building new theaters in Times Square because they need more spaces to take all the shows that are coming, because so many of the theaters are off the market and have been off the market, well, in the case of the Phantom of the Opera, the Majestic, 30 years. The Phantom of the Opera may never close. So, you know, the Majestic, the Minskoff, where The Lion King is, and the Gershwin, where Wicked is, it's entirely possible that those shows will never have another show in them again, because those shows will run forever.
And what about shows that are, because I know you've been critical of Hamilton, even though that's the hottest ticket on Broadway right now.
Yeah, it's not to my taste. I mean, I really have the taste of my grandmother. I like the musicals of Rodgers and Hammerstein and Lerner and Lowe. I'm not a big hip-hop guy. But who am I to argue with a $55 million advance? And everybody else seems to love it, and just about everyone I know who goes to see it loves it. And that does show you, and even though it's not to my taste, I'm delighted with the fact that it's so successful here, because Hamilton is out of the mold. It is not based on a movie that everyone knows. It doesn't have any stars in it. It was just the imagination, the creativity of Lin-Manuel Miranda and his producers backed his rather crazy idea to take a 900-page biography of Alexander Hamilton and turn it into a musical. And even though there are a lot of shows out there where you can see how they're just going to exploit some old catalog from the movie studio because people will know the title of American in Paris or something like that, that's kind of with us now to stay. But there are always going to be the Lin-Manuel Mirandas out there, the David Merricks, the Michael Bennetts, the Bob Fosse's, the Stephen Daldry, a wonderful English director who created Billy Elliot,
right.
Those people who will just imagine shows that you and I have no idea could be a big, big hit. And as long as creative people like that are working in the theater, I can live with the Disney shows that run forever, because there's always going to be something coming along that's fun and exciting. And as the great Hal Prince, the producer and the director, said to me in my book, in the theater, you can't give people what they want. You have to give them something they couldn't even have imagined. And that's when you have great theater and great hits.
I may not live to see our glory.
I may not live to see our glory.
But I will gladly join the fight.
But I will gladly join the fight.
And when our children tell our story.
And when our children tell our story.
They'll tell the story of tonight.
Let's have another round tonight.
Let's have another round tonight.
Let's have another round tonight.
Raise a glass to freedom. Something they can never take away, no matter what they tell you. Raise a glass to the four of us. Tomorrow there'll be more of us telling the story of tonight.
They'll tell the story of tonight.
As we wrap up our conversation, what kind of year was it for you on Broadway? What kind of year do you believe it was?
Financially, it was very robust. I think they made more money this past year than ever before, which is amazing to me, having lived in the past writing this book. When I was writing chapters that took place in the late 60s and early 70s, and I'm seeing Broadway attendance had gone from 10 million to 4 million in just 4 years, and now it's back up to around 13 or 14 million, and I don't know if it can go much higher because there is a limited number of seats on Broadway. That's why they're trying to build new theaters. So financially, it's robust. Artistically, even though I didn't like Hamilton, you'd have to say that it's in pretty good shape as long as something like a Hamilton can come along. So I really don't have any complaints. I would like to see more American non-musical plays, not necessarily cast with stars. We haven't had a great American straight play really since August Osage County several years ago that won the Pulitzer Prize. That had no stars, by the way, but it was a terrific play. I'd like to see more of that. Broadway is now kind of caught up in bringing in things from Britain because it has the patina of sophistication, and New Yorkers are largely Anglophiles, especially the people who go to Broadway, so they love to see their kind of, I call it, Downton Abbey-type theater, where they see their favorite English actors from Masterpiece Theater, or they know that this play is coming from the National Theater of Great Britain, so it has the aura of sophistication about it. And many of those plays are good, and I'm delighted they're there, but I would like to see a revival in the American straight play. I mean, I wish we lived in the era of an Edward Albee or a Arthur Miller, Eugene O'Neill, a Tennessee Williams, because I think that is the best that the American theater has to offer. And it's been a long time since we've had a great, great American play.
I found that interesting this season of even an American play like A View from the Bridge can be done by a British company.
Well, yeah, it's funny because for a long time, America turned its back on Arthur Miller. He was in the wilderness for many, many years. He hadn't had a hit play throughout the 60s and 70s, and he went over to England, and England embraced him and embraced his new work, and they love Arthur Miller over there, and he has done, even his second-tier plays are done all the time in England, so they found something that we had turned our backs on.
The name of the book is Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway. Michael Riedel, I thank you very, very much for spending time with us. Have a great New Year. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Again, the title of the book, Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Michael Riedel is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Come and meet those dancing feet on the avenue I'm taking you to. 42nd Street. Hear the beat of dancing feet.